Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Matthews against Wisconsin Energy. Mr. Andrick.
Good morning, judges of the Seventh Circuit, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Rex Andrig, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Bernadine Matthews, in this case. I should probably say it's good to be back, and of course it's always an honor and a privilege to stand here, but I guess to say that I'm happy to be back wouldn't be entirely true, because it's been kind of a bumpy road since we were last here, at which time this matter was remanded for a jury trial on a breach of contract claim. And as this court knows, there was a jury trial on that claim, and yet we're back here today because we believe, among other things, that instructional error led the jury to do something other than fairly determine whether a breach occurred when Attorney Lynn English violated We Energy's own policy for responding to reference requests. We believe the instructional error caused the jury to decide issues that should never have been put to it and not to decide an issue that should have been put to it. And chief among these was the issue of waiver. More specifically, the jury was instructed to allow Matthews to find that Matthews waived enforcement of the settlement agreement because she had signed a general release to allow Career Consulting Services of America to obtain employment verification information. And the irony of all this is that We Energy's own policy required a written release before it would provide dates of employment, final salary, and last position held, which is what has been referred to colloquially in this case in Lynn English's own words as name, rank, and serial number. So they demanded a written release, and then it became a waiver of enforcement of the contract, and I don't think that's the company policy that anyone had in mind when they executed this contract. There's no question the issue of waiver ultimately played a significant role in this case. It was there from the beginning in opening statements. It was there during the evidentiary portion in the form of testimony, particularly from Lynn English, but also to a lesser degree from Ms. Matthews and Mr. Schwartz, and it was there at the end in closing argument. The problem with allowing waiver to become a major part of this case is that the idea of waiving enforcement of the settlement terms was addressed in the very contract that was before the jury on a breach, and it sort of added insult to injury that the defendant was allowed to argue that there was no breach of a contract by disregarding yet another provision of the same contract. And there was nothing ambiguous about the waiver provision. There was only one way that waiver of enforcement of the agreement could occur, and that would be in another written instrument signed by both parties. And that is the language that should have controlled the waiver issue, not a unilaterally signed general standard form release. And while I know the district court disagreed with that position, I still to this day have difficulty telling you what its reasoning was. It did make some oblique reference to the law recognizing a difference between waiver and modification, but we were never advancing any difference between waiver and modification in the contract provision at play. Certainly didn't draw any distinction between those two. Another issue I'd like to address is the fact that the district court in this case refused to instruct the jury in a manner that would allow for a determination of whether there was a breach of contract independent of whether Matthews suffered any actual damages. And this submitted error had a substantial impact on Matthews' rights and obligations.
Can I ask you just a factual question? Were there any other prospective employers who received references from GE? Or did the jury only hear about Schwartz?
Well, as a matter of fact, there were others, but I think the jury only heard about Schwartz.
They only heard about Schwartz.
That's correct. Getting back to the...
And do you deny that Schwartz was acting as her agent at the time that Schwartz talked to Ms. English?
We do deny that, Your Honor, and we argued to the jury that he was not her agent, that, in fact, she was his client, and that any agency that would be involved in the relationships was that Schwartz was an agent for the Social Security Administration. The error that we submit with regard to not bifurcating the issue of breach from the issue of damages did have a substantial impact on Matthew's rights and obligations. $750,000, as it turned out, because the contract had a fee-shifting provision which turned on the question of a breach, not on the question of whether there was a breach and actual damages. And in reviewing the defendant's response brief, it does not appear to me that they dispute the idea that a breach can stand independent of actual damages. Instead, they argue that the issue was perfectly clear for the jury. But I think the defendant's real position is more accurately reflected in what it actually argued to the jury. And as the defendant conceded, an instruction should be analyzed and examined in the context of, among other things, the closing argument. And it is clear from the defendant's closing argument, it's at page 548 of the transcript, and it's right there in black and white, where the defendant is telling the jury to answer the first special verdict question, no, if it finds that Matthews didn't suffer any damages. And the first special verdict question was whether there was a breach. Now, I think the district court's handling of this issue left a bit to be desired. Again, it did not address this issue until the last minute, which was sort of a chronic problem that we had in this case in getting motions answered and so forth. It didn't seem to disagree with our core position, but sort of reasoned that there was a nominal damages instruction that was sort of a panacea for the issue or problem that we believe existed. And it also implied, the district court did, that any fee-shifting provision was sort of outside the province of the jury. And, of course, we weren't asking that attorney's fees issue be brought to the attention of the jury. That wouldn't be appropriate. But we believed that if the issue had been bifurcated, we would have known what the jury had decided in terms of whether there was a breach independent of damages. In response to the district court's remarks that that this nominal damages instruction sort of fixed everything, I don't really see that as rectifying the problem, because before the jury got that instruction, they were told that to prevail on a breach of contract claim, Bernardine Matthews must prove three elements, and the third element, of course, was identified as damages. Next, the jury was told that if they find that Bernardine Matthews didn't prove all three elements, they should return a verdict in favor of the defendant. And that's at page 13 of the instructions, which is Appendix G to our brief. But then the jury was told that if Bernardine Matthews failed to prove all elements on the breach of contract claim, which it had defined as involving the three elements including damages, quote, then you will not consider the question of damages, close quote. So the problem that we have is that we believe the jury may have found that there was a breach, that there just weren't any demonstrable actual damages, but answered the first question no, and were left without knowing whether the jury believed there was a breach. And it seems to me that the defendant seized upon this formulation of the instructions to argue for no breach because there were no damages. Even the nominal damage instruction, I would point out, assumes that there was an injury, just an injury or damages without monetary value. I'd like to address briefly the question about whether the idea of a waiver should have or could have been put to the jury. I guess I'd first point out that the idea that the common law sometimes allows a jury to decide whether a party has waived enforcement of a contract is an idea that has been brought up in the response brief, but is also an idea that was never raised below. The defendant didn't make this argument. I think it should be barred from making it now. We never saw the case law on which the defendant now purports to rely, and we weren't referred to those cases by the court either. And the court never articulated that basis for allowing the instruction. We did try to raise this issue of waiver.
I'm not sure how far these arguments about waiver get you. There's a clause in the Securities Act of 1933 which says that no one can waive his rights under this statute. That is, you can't agree to be defrauded. Do you think that, and one of the rights under the statute is the right to sue. Do you think that means that everybody must sue about every potential securities offense? Since you can't waive your rights, you must sue. And then you can't settle the case, you must pursue it to trial. And if you get a damages verdict, you must collect it. You can't agree to accept less than your maximum entitlement because it says no waiver. You think that's what a no waiver clause really means, that you can't unilaterally accept less than your due?
No, I mean, I think that you can, and I guess I'm not familiar, you know, with the act that Your Honor has.
Well, it's in 1933, so you were probably.
You're familiar with a lot of statutes that contain no waiver clause. The Fair Labor Standards Act has a no waiver clause, right? There just can't be any waiver. But that doesn't mean that everybody must sue or must get the most possible, right? It's possible unilaterally to accept less than your due without violating a no-waiver rule. Isn't that what this waiver instruction really meant? The plaintiff was agreeing to accept less than her due under the contract?
Well, I think the waiver provision, which is kind of where it all begins, certainly allowed the plaintiff to waive any level of her rights all the way up to her complete right of enforcement. And I guess I would point out that one thing that happened in this particular case with regard to waiver is that the way that waiver was construed, this was not the plaintiff accepting less than she was entitled to. This particular waiver turned out to be the plaintiff sort of renunciating the entirety of the agreement, because the idea that she wanted enforcement of the reference request policy was sort of the...
There's no argument here that the entire agreement has been changed. Right? The waiver instruction, as I understand it, just said that the plaintiff, defendant's position was that the plaintiff had agreed that this particular representative could receive the same information that she already had, could receive it both from her. I assume you think that if Matthews told Schwartz that she had been fired or that she had sued Wisconsin Energy, that wouldn't violate the agreement.
That would have, yes. And she testified.
Would have violated the agreement if Matthews had told Schwartz?
If Matthews was sort of under a confidentiality clause that she couldn't discuss any of the provisions of the settlement agreement.
Yes, but would it violate the agreement if Matthews had said, you know, Matthews is trying to get Schwartz to help her find a job. She says, look, my employment history ended poorly at Wisconsin Energy. I can't discuss the settlement agreement, but I was fired. I sued them twice. Right? The fact that she sued them twice is a public record, for heaven's sake. It would be unlawful for somebody to agree to keep a public record secret.
That's true, although I do want to clarify that she wasn't fired.
Don't try to talk over a question.
I'm sorry.
If it's lawful for Matthews to reveal that information to Schwartz, why would it somehow be forbidden for Matthews to allow Schwartz to verify that information? Right? Far as I can see, that's all the waiver instruction here entailed.
Well, I think what the waiver instruction hearing entailed from my perspective and from the perspective of reading the closing arguments and being at the trial was that Matthews had a provision in that contract where We Energies was required to follow its own reference request policy when receiving reference requests. And what the waiver turned out to be was that Matthews was waiving that provision. I mean, that's how it was presented to the jury, that she was waiving her right, which was really sort of the whole, in my view of the settlement agreement, was sort of the essentials of the agreement was she'd had these problems with reference requests in the past, and so what she wanted, what we gave her, which all that she ever wanted, was that if somebody called for a reference request, that they would follow their own policy, and what she ended up waiving was that entire premise of the settlement agreement. And I guess just to make one final remark, I see that my rebuttal time has started. Certainly Matthews could have waived the entirety of the agreement or something less than that, but the agreement was that she wouldn't do that unless that was in writing.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mishlove.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In just over a month, the parties to this action will have the unenviable honor of celebrating their sixth year anniversary of litigating this case in federal court.
It's a lot short of Jarndyce against Jarndyce.
Nevertheless, we believe it's time to bring this one to an end. Ms. Matthews has had her day in court now. She tried her breach of contract case to a 12-member jury, and the jury soundly rejected it, and decidedly so. We respectfully submit that the assignments of error that Ms. Matthews urges upon the court in this appeal are meritless, and we certainly argue that the errors that she urges are not errors that would be proper grounds for reversal under Rule 61's standard, which directs this court to disregard error that does not affect the substantial rights of the parties. Mr. Anderegg has focused on instructional error, and it's noteworthy in that regard that at least two of the issues that are challenged in this appeal are instructions that were submitted by Ms. Matthews jointly with the defendant as part of the party's pretrial report. And the instruction as to what a plaintiff must show in order to prevail on a breach of contract is one of those instructions that was submitted to the court as an instruction that was mutually agreed upon by the parties. In effectuating Rule 61, the court often asks whether or not the errors that are urged upon the court are errors that would have, but for their occurrence, would have resulted in a different outcome in the case. And we would respectfully submit that that's certainly not the case here. Almost by any angle that you look at it, this case and what happened in trial, the same outcome would have been reached, the same verdict would have been reached by the jury, notwithstanding any of these particular instances of error that are urged upon by the court. I have outlined many of those in the brief, and I'm not going to reiterate them here unless they become something worth discussing. I would point out, however, that when this court remanded this matter for a trial, the court made it quite clear that what the reference request provisions of the agreement meant was an issue for the jury to decide, and the issue of whether or not there was a breach of those provisions was an issue for the jury to decide. And I think that the jury could reasonably have concluded that there was no breach because, among other things, Ms. Matthews fell far short of establishing at any time, through any of the evidence that was adduced at trial, either what the provisions of the reference request provisions in the agreement meant or what the parameters and contours were of Wisconsin Energy's policy with respect to reference requests. I'd like to move, if I could, directly to the issue of agency, because I think that once one sees that there was sufficient evidence in front of the jury for the jury to conclude that Mr. Schwartz was in fact acting at all times as Ms. Matthews' agent, virtually all of the issues that are raised on appeal become academic questions. And the evidence in that regard largely begins and ends with the fact that as part of their case in chief, Ms. Matthews read into the evidence in front of the jury a stipulation that read as follows. The defendant will not argue that Schwartz's status as Ms. Matthews' agent was negated by virtue of the fact that she previously assigned her ticket to work to the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. We could quibble about what exactly that stipulation meant. We could disagree about the purpose that it was read into the record as a matter of evidence for the jury. But I think one thing that there's not much reasonable quibbling about is that with a stipulation like that effectively presupposes the status of Mr. Schwartz as Ms. Matthews' agent, a jury reasonably could have found that Mr. Schwartz was at all times, in fact, acting as Ms. Matthews' agent.
Let me ask you a question here that I know there's been a lot of back and forth, but this doesn't seem like all that complicated a case. How in the world do the attorney's fees get to be over $500,000 in a case like this?
Well, it's a fair question, and we don't gainsay the amount of money. It's a lot of money, but it is, first of all, what Ms. Matthews bargained for. The answer to your question is, I think it's fair to say there came a point in time where We Energies rightfully, having been on the other side of lawsuits with Ms. Matthews on numerous occasions, came to a point where it felt that this time, maybe, just maybe, a fraud was being perpetrated against it, and for that matter, on the court. As I allude to in our briefs, there was smoking gun evidence of Mr. Schwartz manufacturing phony footers on the bottom of his documents in order to further his claim, which was thoroughly refuted at court during the course of trial, that he changed her resume after and as a result of speaking to Ms. English. The evidence was clear that he made that change weeks before he ever talked to Ms. English, sent it to Ms. Matthews and her lawyer with a cover letter saying, I'm prepared to send this off as soon as you give me your approval. He didn't change that afterwards, and he manufactured phony footers that were put up for the jury to see with so many mistakes in it, it was embarrassing. And there came a time where I think We Energies rightfully said, we're going to do what we need to do in order to ferret out this manufactured claim and defeat it once and for all. And without having done so, there wouldn't have come that time where at like 3 in the morning, one of the associates who was charged with putting together all the evidence looked at these footers and saw for the first time and had an aha experience. Oh my goodness, look at this. This is a phony document. They needed to do what they needed to do. That's my first point. My second point is, it's a lot of money, but I don't know how to evaluate that in a vacuum. They steadfastly refused, despite all of the hints from this court and the district court in its Medavante opinion, that one of the relevant factors is how much attorney's fees did they incur? They remained mum about that. They remained silent about that. I can tell you that several weeks before trial, there was a settlement demand in excess of $500,000. For the company to decide under all of these circumstances that it was going to expend another $500,000 to defeat a claim where they're being told that the demand is $500,000 to settle, I can't say that it's commercially unreasonable under the circumstances. I can't say that it's something, and I don't think it doesn't matter what I can say. I don't think the court abused its discretion in deciding that $500,000 worth of attorney's fees was something that shocked the conscience or where equity ought to intervene.
It just seems like a heck of a lot of money.
It is a heck of a lot of money, and I think the reality of the situation is this is an unfortunate circumstance, and I don't think anyone that attended that trial could have walked out without feeling some sort of a pit in their stomach about whether or not the rule of law was really being respected in this case. The stipulation that was read into evidence, of course, wasn't the only evidence that spoke to the issue of agency. And I want to just remind the court that the other evidence that was put into the trial was evidence that indicated that Ms. Schwartz executed an authorization form giving Ms. Matthews executed an authorization and release form giving Mr. Schwartz specific permission to talk to third parties about information which he may have determined to be relevant to her job search.
Would a normal person, an employer seeking information from We Energies about a former employee, talk to Ms. English from the legal department? Would she handle things like that?
Ms. English's testimony was that as in the normal course of things, she doesn't routinely get involved in dealing with inquiries that come in regarding employees. But this inquiry that came in had a number of red flags regarding...
What did because
there was ongoing
litigation with them. So that's why it's referred to.
That's why
instead of the Human Resource Department, it goes to Ms. English.
Well, and the fact that Mr. Schwartz faxed his letter to a vice president that is literally, and the evidence in trial showed this, was literally four levels of separation beyond the folks that deal with this sort of thing. So here we have an inquiry regarding an employee using some buzzwords that are quite at the core of the ongoing litigation being sent to a vice president. And under the circumstances, it was brought to Ms. English's attention. I'll finish up this issue in just a moment. Ms. Matthews' own testimony, and this is important, was that she understood that she was giving Mr. Schwartz authorization to approach whoever he thought he needed to approach for purposes of helping her, and that she was giving authority or permission to her former employers to be able to provide information to Mr. Schwartz, to provide the information that he requested. And the information that's at the heart of this case, that Ms. Matthews had sued Wisconsin Energies, information which, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, is public information, was in direct response to a question, why won't you answer my questions? Why won't you tell me the stuff that I'm asking you under the phone? After being badgered like that for most of the phone call, Ms. English answered the question. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the issue of waiver. With respect to both the agency instructions and the waiver instructions, I think it's important to bear in mind that Ms. Matthews is not challenging the correctness of the law. There are no claims here that the law was misstated with respect to these instructions. The claim here is that the evidence at trial was insufficient to warrant the giving of an instruction. We respectfully submit that on the evidence that I just read to you, there was sufficient evidence before the jury for it to reasonably return a verdict, to reasonably find either that there was an agency relationship and that there was a waiver of Ms. Matthews' rights with respect to the company's obligations under the agreement. And I always have to return to the fact that at the end of the day, there was insufficient evidence that was put on that even established the parameters of what the company's obligations were under the agreement. Speaking very briefly to the issue of breach, the alleged error that relates to the giving of the instructions relating to what a plaintiff must establish in order to prevail on a breach of contract claim, I think it's important to be clear about the fact that that is what the instruction was. It was an instruction as to what a plaintiff must establish in order to prevail on her breach of contract claim. And in this case, Ms. Matthews' claim was a claim for monetary damages arising out of a breach of contract, a claim for monetary damages both compensatory and consequential of an unspecified amount as a result of a breach of contract. And one understands the nature of the claim, the instruction is unassailable. And not only is it unassailable, it tracks directly what this court said a plaintiff needed to show in the Matthews 1 decision, if you will, at page 553 of 534 F sup, where the court said, the plaintiff must show a valid contract that the defendant breached and damages flowing from that breach. I think that there isn't any question that the instruction is unassailably correct. I believe that Ms. Matthews recognized that when she agreed to submit this very language to the court as part of the party's joint pretrial report. The only thing that changed, the only thing that made that occasioned an emergency motion for bifurcation of the jury instructions is that there was a day of trial and Ms. Matthews saw the direction that her case was headed. Then and only then did the issue of the possibility of a finding of a breach without any finding of damage, only then did that become salient. And Mr. Anderegg made reference to the fact, lamented the fact that the court didn't deal with things or dealt with things at the last hour. I don't think it's fair to lay these issues at the court of the at the feet of the district judge. The fact of the matter is the issue wasn't raised till the 11th hour. In evaluating the a jury instructions are to be considered both in the context of the other instructions given and in light of the allegations, the claim being made, if you will, the opening and closing arguments, and the evidence of record. Jury instructions are to be examined in their entirety to determine whether, as a whole, they were likely to have substantially impaired the jury's ability to understand the case, and we would respectfully submit that when these instructions are viewed in their entirety, there is little reasonable argument that they could be said to have impaired the jury's ability to understand the case. And I would point out in that regard that the defendant in this case attempted repeatedly to have the case submitted to a jury with special interrogatories, because as simple as the case may be, on its face there's actually a number of kind of complicated causal issues. And so we tried diligently to have the case submitted along with special interrogatories. That effort was repeatedly opposed and successfully opposed by the plaintiff. So when one considers whether or not this is a case in which it would be a miscarriage of justice not to rectify the error that's claimed by the plaintiff, we'd respectfully submit that this is a case where any ambiguity or confusion that the that the plaintiff believed might have been occasioned by the instructions could have been remedied by the simple expedient of submitting an interrogatory along with the verdict, which was a measure that was opposed and successfully opposed by the plaintiff. Judge Evans raised the issue of attorney's fees. We've briefed that issue quite extensively. I don't have a lot to add. I would like to say that I don't think that there's any reasonable question that the district court properly applied the commercial reasonableness standard of MedCom and its progeny. One of the reasons the attorney fees got so high is because we repeatedly found ourselves having to respond to arguments that were that only could have been written with a total disregard of circuit precedent. And in this case, there is not a single mention of this court's decision in Medavante, another case that came from Judge Stadmuller's chambers, a case about which the plaintiff was most surely aware. And so we ended up spending a bunch of time having to research whether or not the quantification of the of a reasonable amount of fees is a federal question or a state question. Medavante makes it completely clear that it's a federal question. It has to do with how these federal courts are going to allocate its time and resources in connection with reviewing contractual fee agreements. That's one of the reasons that the attorney's fees get so high in this case. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Anderegg?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think I need to respond to the idea that the evidence was manufactured in this case, and I prefer not to have to spend my time doing that, but that is fairly liable as claim. And nobody manufactured any evidence in this case, Your Honor. There's this claim that Howard Schwartz, the so-called smoking gun evidence, because there was a copy of Ms. Matthews' resume or a version of that that had a date signature on the bottom and the computer entry actually associated with her resume when he had opened the document and looked at it and printed it out and then closed it just before the deposition. And because the computer, I think he, in all likelihood, saved that document, and we all know that we're prompted to do that, and then the date modified changes, even though there's been no changes made to the document. And I really think they took advantage of an elderly and honorable man who was not computer savvy and incapable of explaining why the
you
date modified changed.
Go ahead.
Well, I didn't mean to do that, and I certainly that wasn't my intent, although definitely honorable. They falsely portrayed him as being a cheat. And the evidence is not manufactured in this case, and certainly nobody manufactured the Lynn English's response to the reference request. Nobody prompted her to do that. There were no buzzwords in the request. There was nothing unusual about the request or the release that was forwarded. It was clearly a standard form release. It wasn't manufactured in conjunction with the request. It had been signed 4 months earlier. It didn't reference We Energies. And, Schwartz didn't call English to get the information. Ms. English called Howard Schwartz to give the information. And her testimony is that all she told Howard Schwartz is that he was going to get name, rank, and serial number. And, of course, she gave a lot more than that. And it was in this context that, according to Howard Schwartz, according to Lynn English, actually, he asked her twice if she would just give the information over the phone. The record does not support the idea that he badgered her for 10 minutes for this information. In the brief, they claim he repeatedly implored her to just answer her questions. That wasn't even her own testimony. It mischaracterizes the testimony in this record. The third problem is that even if he had been asking for more information...
We're not the jury. You would be best served focusing on the legal issues in this case.
Okay.
Such as jury instructions.
Okay. Well, to the extent, I guess I'm trying to argue the harmless error aspect of the case, but I will return to the jury instruction aspect. I think in terms of the agency instruction, we have this stipulation, and I think I probably should address that with the remaining time that I have. And, I would certainly agree that that one may have gotten past us. Certainly, though, we did not stipulate to the fact that Howard Schwartz was an agent of Ms. Matthews, and it was argued rather vociferously to the jury that that was not the case. Furthermore, we believe that the instruction to the agency instruction, to the extent that it said whatever Ms. English said to Howard Schwartz was tantamount to having said that directly to Lynn English, would be contrary to the prior decision in this course, which recognized Howard Schwartz's unique and distinct role with regard to Ms. Matthews. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.